The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. My name is Andy Cahan. I'm Director of Author Events, and I'm very pleased to welcome all of you here this evening. Since your program has a useful rundown of both authors' numerous books, awards, achievements, and encomiums, I thought I'd have a little fun and just offer a brief quote about each of our guests by a writer whom I admire. To wit, Jonathan Dee, one of my favorite writers and a man known for the acuity of his observations, writes, 50 years from now, it may well turn out that the work of very few American writers has as much to say about what it means to be alive in our time as that of Laurie Moore. And here is Gary Steingart, another one of my favorite writers, freaking out about Chang Rae Lee's Native Speaker. I was in awe of it, even just the way it starts. The guy's drunk. He goes through this whole list of everything that one feels about being an outsider in America. But in this playful, almost insane way, it feels much more natural than the kind of mannered novel of the immigrant experience where, oh, one is introduced to the hardships suffered by the group. That's in there too, but it was irreverent and deep, and I thought, holy shit, I want what he's having. So let's have what they are having. Please welcome our first presenter, Chang Rae Lee.
Hello, thank you for coming out. I'm just going to read a few pages here because, you know, partly, really, most of the reason I'm here is I wanted to hear Laurie Moore. Because Laurie's the greatest. I'm just going to read a few pages from the beginning of my new novel, On Such a Full Sea, and it's sort of a, I guess, a brief little introduction to the voice of the narrators, but a little presentation, a portrait of the hero, heroine fan. It is known where we come from, but no one much cares about things like that anymore. We think, why bother? Except for a lucky few, everyone is from someplace, but that someplace, it turns out, is gone. You can search it. You can find pics or vids that show what the place last looked like. In our case, a gravel-colored town of stoop-shouldered buildings on a riverbank in China, shorn hills in the distance, rooftops a mess of wires and junk, the river tea-still, a swath of black. And blunting it all is a haze that you can almost smell, a smell you think you don't want to breathe in. So what does it matter if the town was raised one day after our people were trucked out? What difference does it make that there's almost nothing there now? It was on the other side of the world, which might as well be a light year away. Though probably it was mourned when it was thriving. People are funny that way. Even the most miserable kind of circumstance can inspire a genuine throb of nostalgia. The blood was pumping, yes? Weren't we alive? You can bet that where we live now was mourned too in its time. And though it may be surprising to consider, someday this community might be remembered as an excellent place, even by those of us who recognize its shortcomings. But we don't wish to dwell on the unhappier details. Most would agree that any rational person would leap at the chance of living here in Beemore, given what it's like out there beyond the walls, in the open counties. And even those relative few who've secured a spot in the charter villages might find certain aspects of life here enviable, though they would definitely never say so. We, on the other hand, will offer this. You can rely on the time here, the tread of the hours. If you think about it, there's little else that's more important than having a schedule, and better yet, counting on that schedule. It helps one to sleep more soundly, to work steadily through one shift, maybe even to digest the hearty meals, and finally to enjoy all the free time available to us right up to the last minutes of the evening. Then, if the stars are out, and they do seem to be out most every night now, We can sit together in our backyards and wave a hand to neighbors over the fences and view our favorite programs while sitting in the open air and authentically believe that this stretch of sky sings its chorus of light for us alone. Who would tell us we are wrong? Let them come forward. Let them try to shake our walls. Our footings are dug deep. And if they like, they can even bring up the tale of Fan, the young woman whose cause has been taken up by a startling number of us. She's now gone from here, and whether she's enduring or suffering or dead is a matter for her household, whatever their disposition. They are gone too, transferred to another facility in the far west, the best scenario for them after the strife she caused. We can talk about her openly because hers is no grand tragedy, no apocalypse of the soul or of our times. Yes, there are those who would like to believe otherwise, that each and every being in the realm is a microcosm of the realm, that we are heartened and chastened and diminished and elevated by a singular reflection. This is a fetching idea, metaphorically and otherwise, most often enlisted for promoting the greater good. But more and more, we can see that the question is not whether we are individuals. We can't help but be. This has been proved case by case. We are not drones or robots and never will be. The question, then, is whether being an individual makes a difference anymore, that it can matter at all, and if not, whether we in fact care. Did Fan care about such things? We can't be certain. We know much about her daily life, but that still leaves a great deal to be determined. She was perhaps brighter than most, certainly less talkative, but otherwise, in terms of character, not terribly distinctive. Nor would anyone have thought that she could do the thing she did. Such a lamentable action. She did stand out physically, and not because she was beautiful. She was pleasing enough to look at. She was tiny, was the thing, just 150 centimeters, or not quite 5 feet tall, and slim besides, which made her the perfect size for her job in the tanks. At 16, she had the stature of a girl of 11 or 12, and thereby, when first encountered, she could appear to possess a special perspective that one might automatically call wisdom, but is perhaps more a kind of timelessness of view, the capacity, as a child might have, to see things and people and events without the muddle of the present and all it contains. Perhaps Fan truly had that kind of clarity and not just a semblance of it. But if we may, let us picture her before the trouble, just as she was, clad in black neoprene, only the pale gleam of her bare feet and hands and face to indicate her humanity. Once she pulled on gloves and flippers and her eye mask, she looked like a creature of prey, a sleek dark seabird knifing into the waters. Of course, that's not what she did in the tanks, where her job was to husband and nurture the valuable fish that allow our community to do so well in this mostly difficult world. She was one of the best in her function as a diver, easily able to hold her breath for 2 minutes or more while she scrubbed and vacuumed and replaced tubing and filters and patched whatever tears had formed in the linings, a half-weight vest to hold her beneath the surface. Even that was almost too heavy for her, and she would have to bend her knees while at the bottom of the 2 meter deep water and propel herself upward to breathe before descending again, her various tools attached to her work belt. Once submerged, a diver is not easily seen. Given all the fish in the water, naturally as many healthy fish are raised as possible, she is a mere shadow among them, trained to do her tasks quickly and unobtrusively. That is why she uses no special breathing apparatus aside from a snorkel, compressed gases causing too much of a disturbance. Fearful fish are not happy fish. The diver is not one of them, but is part of the waterscape from the time they are hatchlings. And they see her customary form and the repeated cadence of her movements and the gentle motor of her flippered feet that must come to them like a motherly lullaby, a dream song of refuge, right up to the moment of harvest. The diver is there at harvest, of course, and sees to it that the very last of them finds its way into the chute. And it is only then, for the span of the few hours while the tank is being cleaned and filtered before the next generation of hatchlings is released, that the water is clear of activity, that the diver is alone. How somber a period that must be. The constant light from the grow bulbs filtering through the canopy of vegetables and herbs and ornamental flowers suspended above the tanks throws blue-green glints about the facility walls, this cool Amazonian hue that suggests a fecundity primordial and unceasing. The diver inspects each aquarium, which is roughly the dimension of a badminton court, and by the end, she is exhausted not by the work or holding her breath, but instead from the strange exertion of pushing against the emptiness. For she is accustomed to the buoying lift of their numbers, how sometimes the fish seem to gird her and bear her along the tank walls like a living scaffold, or perhaps lead her to one of their dead by swarming about its upended corpse, or even playfully school themselves into just her shape and become her mirror in the water. At the pellet drop, they are simply fish again, and thrash upward, mouths agape, the vibrato of the water chattering and electric, as if bees were madly attempting to pass through her suit. And wouldn't it be truth enough to speak of those bristling hundreds as not only being cared for by the diver, but as serving to shepherd her too through the march of days? For who is she, given the many hours she and all the other members of her household spend at their jobs, and how generally sparse their conversation is during downtime, or when they're having their morning or evening meal while watching a vid or game? All around Bmore, it's much the same, which is happy enough. But maybe it's the laboring that gives you shape. Might the most fulfilling times be those spent solo at your tasks, literally immersed or not, when you are able to uncover the smallest surprises and unlikely details of some process or operation that in turn exposes your proclivities and prejudices both. And whether or not there is anything to be done about it, you begin to learn what you value most. For Fan, more than the other divers, took to the tanks with a quiet abandon, rarely climbing out at the ending hour to peel herself of the suiting in the changing room with the others. She would appear just as they were leaving for home. Or if she didn't and they grew concerned, someone would go to her tanks and check that she was still working. For divers have perished from time to time, as they can believe too well that they are one of the throng. But Fan would be there, simply swimming about, scrubbing or patching. And the other diver would splash the water and wait until Fan surfaced with a thumbs up. She once told us that she almost preferred being in the tanks than out in the air of Bmore, that she liked the feeling of having to hold her breath and go against her nature, which made her more aware of herself as this mere lone body. In the hour or so after the shift, with no more tasks to be done, she would pull her knees to her chest and drift to the bottom and stay there in that crouch until her lungs screamed for forgiveness. She wasn't inviting oblivion or even testing herself, but rather summoning a different kind of force that would transform not her, but the composition of the realm, make it so the water could not harm her. And we would say, "Please, Fan, please. You cannot truly believe this." And she would almost smile and mostly nod, but the impression you were left with was that she did, in fact, believe in such a possibility. And if that is an indication of her instability, everything else that happened makes sense and no more needs to be accounted for. But let's suppose another way of considering her, which was that she had a special conviction of imagination. Few of us do, to be honest. We wish and wish, and often with fury, but never very deeply. For if we did, we'd see how the world can sometimes split open in just the way we hope, that it and we are, in fact, unbounded, free. Thanks. I'll stop there.
That was fantastic. And, you know, a reading that ends with the word free at the free library, I just feel very superfluous being here. I'm going to read a story called, it's called Thank You for Having Me. And it's how I feel. Thank you for having me. Hoping I can somehow get my glasses right here. Okay, we'll see. The day following Michael Jackson's death, I was constructing my own memorial for him. I played his videos on YouTube and sat in the kitchen at night with the iPod light at the table's center, the only source of illumination. I listened to Man in the Mirror and Ben, my favorite, even if it was about a killer rat. I tried not to think about its being about a rat, as it was also the name of an old beau who had emailed me from Istanbul upon hearing of Jackson's death. Apparently there was no one in Turkey to talk about it with. When I heard the news of M. Jackson's death, I thought of you, the expo had written, and that sweet loose-limbed dance you used to do to one of his up-tempo numbers. I tried to think positively. Well, at least Whitney Houston didn't die, I said to someone on the phone. Every minute that ticked by in life contained very little information, until suddenly it contained too much. Mom, what are you doing? Asked my 15-year-old daughter, Nikki. You look like a crazy lady sitting in the kitchen like this. I'm just listening to some music, I said. But like this? I didn't want to disturb you, I said. You are so totally disturbing me, she said. Nikki had lately announced a desire to have her own reality show so that the whole world could see what she had to put up with. I pulled out the earbuds. What are you wearing tomorrow? Whatever. I mean, does it matter? No, not really. Nikki sauntered out of the room. Of course it did not matter what young people wore. They were already amazing looking without really knowing it, which was also part of their beauty. I was going to be Nikki's date at the wedding of Maria, her former babysitter, and Nikki was going to be mine. The person who needed to be careful what she wore was me. It was a wedding in the country, a half-hour drive, and we arrived on time, but somehow we seemed the last ones there. Guests milled about semi-purposefully. Maria, an attractive, restless Brazilian, was marrying a local farm boy for the second time, a second farm boy on a second farm. The previous farm boy she had married, Ian, was present as well. He had been hired to play music, and as the guests floated by with their plastic cups of wine, Ian sat there playing a slow, melancholic version of I Want You Back. Except he didn't seem to want her back. He was smiling and nodding at everyone and seemed happy to be part of this send-off. He was the entertainment. He wore a T-shirt that read, Thank you for having me. This seemed remarkably sanguine and useful, as well as a little beautiful. I wondered how it was done. I, myself, had never done anything remotely similar. Marriage is one long conversation, wrote Robert Louis Stevenson. Of course, he died when he was 44, so he had no idea how long the conversation could really get to be. I can't believe you wore that, Nikki whispered to me in her mauve eyelet sundress. I know, I said, it probably was a mistake. I was wearing a synthetic leopard print sheath. I admired camouflage. A leopard's markings, I'd imagined, existed because a leopard's habitat had once been alive with snakes and blending in was required. Leopards were frightened of snakes and also of chimpanzees, who were in turn frightened of leopards, a standoff between predator and prey, since there was a confusion as to which was which. This was also a theme in the wilds of my closet. Perhaps I had watched too many nature documentaries. Maybe you could get Ian some lemonade, I said to Nikki. I had already grabbed some wine from a passing black tray. "Yes, maybe I could," she said, and loped across the yard. I watched her broad, tan back and her confident gait. She was a gorgeous giantess. I was in awe to have such a daughter, also in fear, as in fearful for my life. "It's good you and Maria have stayed friends," I said to Ian. Ian's father, who had one of those embarrassing father-in-law crushes on his son's departing wife, was not taking it so well. One could see Ian's father, misty-eyed, treading the edge of the property with some iced gin, keeping his eye out for Maria, waiting for her to come out of the house, waiting for an opening when she might be free of others so he could rush up and embrace her. "Yes," Ian smiled. Ian sighed. And for a fleeting moment, everything felt completely fucked up. And then everything righted itself again. It felt important spiritually to go to weddings, to give balance to the wakes and memorial services. People shouldn't have been set in motion on this planet only to grieve losses. And without weddings, there were only funerals. I had seen a soccer mom become a rhododendron with a plaque next to the soccer field parking lot, as if it had been watching all those matches that had killed her. I had seen a brilliant young student become a creative writing contest, as if it were all that writing that had been the thing to do him in, and I had seen a public defender become a justice fund, as if one paid for fairness with one's very life. I had seen a dozen people become hunks of rock with their names engraved so shockingly perfectly upon the surface it looked as if they had indeed turned to stone, been given new life the way the moon is given it, through some lighting tricks and a face-like font. I had turned 100 Rolodex cards around to their blank sides. So let a babysitter become a bride again. Let her marry over and over. So much urgent and lifelike love went rumbling around underground and died there, never got expressed at all. So let some errant, inconvenient attraction have its way. There was so little time. Someone very swanky and tall and in muddy high heels in the grass was now standing in front of Ian, holding a microphone and singing Waters of March while Ian accompanied. "There are a bazillion Brazilians here," said Nicky, arriving with two lemonades. "What did you expect?" I took one of the lemonades for Ian and put my arm around her. "I don't know. I only ever met her sister just once. The upside is at least I'm not the only one wearing a color," she said. We gazed across the long yard of the farmhouse. Maria's sister and her mother were by the rose bushes having their pictures taken without the bride. "Maria and her sister both look like their mother," I said. Her mother and I had met once before, and I now nodded in her direction across the yard. I couldn't tell if she could see me. Nicky nodded with a slight smirk. "Yeah, well, their father died in a car crash, so they don't look like him." I swatted her arm. "Nicky, sheesh." She was silent for a while. "Do you ever think of Dad?" "Dad who?" I asked. "Come on. You mean Daddy?" The weekend her father left the house, the town, the country, everything packing so lightly I believed he would come back. He had said, "You can raise Nicky by yourself. You'll be good at it." And I had said, "Are you on crack?" And he had replied, continuing to fold a blue twill jacket, "Yes, a little." "Dadder as in batter," Nicky said now. She sometimes claimed to friends that her father had died. And when she was asked how he had died, she would gaze bereavedly off into the distance and say, "A really, really serious game of hangman." Mothers and their only children of divorce were a skewed family dynamic, if they were families at all. Perhaps they were more like cruddy buddy movies, and the dialogue between them was unrecognizable as filial or parental. It was extraterrestrial, with a streak of dog walkers meeting at the park. It contained more sibling banter than it should. Still, I preferred the whole thing to being a lonely old spinster, the fate I had once thought I was most genetically destined for, though I'd worked hard, too hard, to defy and avoid it, when perhaps there it lay ahead of me regardless. If you were alone when you were born, excuse me, alone when you were dying, really absolutely alone when you were dead, why learn to be alone in between? If you had forgotten, it would quickly come back to you. Aloneness was like riding a bike at gunpoint with a gun in your own hand. Aloneness was the air in your tires, the wind in your hair. You didn't have to go looking for it with open arms. With open arms, you fell off the bike. I was drinking my wine too quickly. Maria came out of the house in her beautiful shoulderless wedding dress, which was white as could be. What a fantastic costume, said Nikki archly. Nikki was both keen observer and enthusiastic participant in the sartorial disguise department, and when she was little, there had been much playing of wedding, fake bridal bouquets made of ragged plastic-handled sponges tossed up into the air and often into the garage hoop, catching there. She was also into Halloween. She would trick-or-treat for UNICEF, dressed in a sniper outfit or a suicide bomber outfit replete with vest. Once, when she was 8, she went as a dryad, a tree nymph, and when asked at doors what she was, she kept saying, a tree nip. She had been a haughty trick-or-treater, alert to the failed guessing game of it. You're a what, a vampire? So when neighbors looked confused, she scowled and said reproachfully, have you never studied Greek mythology? Nikki knew how to terrify. She had sometimes been more interested in answering our own door than in knocking on others, peering around the edge of it with a witch hat and a loud cackle. I think it's time to get back to the customers, she announced to me one Halloween when she was five, grabbing my hand and racing back to our house. She was fearless. She had always chosen the peanut allergy table at school since a boy she liked sat there. The cafeteria version of the Magic Mountain. Nikki's childhood, like all dreams, sharpened artificially into stray vignettes when I tried to conjure it, then faded away entirely. Now tall and long-limbed and inscrutable, she seemed more than ever like a sniper. I felt paralyzed beside her, and the love I had for her was less for this new spiky Nikki than for the old spiky one, which was still inside her somewhere, though it was a matter of faith to think so. Surely that was why faith had been invented, to raise teenagers without dying. Although, of course, it was also why death was invented, to escape teenagers altogether. When, in the last few months, Nikki had stood her ground in various rooms of the house, screaming at me abusively, I would begin mutely to disrobe, slowly lifting my shirt over my head so as not to see her, and only that would send her flying out of the room in disgust. Only nakedness was silencing, but at least something was. I can't believe Maria's wearing white, said Nikki. I shrugged. What color should she wear? Gray, Nikki said immediately, to acknowledge having a brain. Actually, I said, I saw something on PBS recently that said only the outer bark of the brain, and it does look like bark, is gray. Apparently, the other half of the brain has a lot of white matter for connectivity. Nikki snorted, as she often did when I uttered the letters PBS. Then she should wear gray in acknowledgement of having half a brain, said Nikki. I nodded. I get your point, I said. Guests were eating canapes on paper plates and having their pictures taken with the bride. Not so much with Maria's new groom, a boy named Hank, which was not short for Henry, but for Johannes, and who was not wearing sunglasses like everyone else, but was sort of squinting at Maria in pride and disbelief. Hank was also a musician, and though he mostly repaired banjos and guitars, restrung and varnished them, and that was how he, Maria, and Ian had all met. Now the air was filled with the old silver jewelry smell of oncoming rain. I edged toward Ian, who was looking for the next song, idly strumming, trying not to watch his father eye Maria. What you got? I'll be there, I asked cheerfully. I'd always liked Ian. He had chosen Maria like a character, met her on a semester abroad and then come home already married to her, much to the marveling of his dad. Ian loved Maria and was always loyal to her no matter what story she was in. But Maria was a narrative girl, and the story had to be spellbinding or she lost interest in the main character, who was sometimes herself and sometimes not. She was destined to marry and marry and marry. Ian smiled and began to sing, "I Will Always Love You," sounding oddly like Bob Dylan. I swayed, I stayed, I did not get in the way. "You are a saint," I said when he finished. He was a sweet boy, and when Nikki was little, he had often come over and played soccer in the yard with her and Maria. "Oh, no, I'm just a deposed king of corn. She bought the farm, I sold it to her, and then she flipped it and bought this one instead." He motioned toward the endless field beyond the tent, where the corn was midget and standing in mud, June not having been hot enough to evaporate the puddles. The tomatoes and marijuana would not do well this year. "Last night I had a dream," he said, "that I was in West Side Story and had forgotten all the words to I Like to Be in America." "Doesn't take a genius to figure that one out." "No," I said, "I guess not." "Jesus, what is my dad doing?" Ian said, looking down and away. Ian's father was still prowling the perimeter, a little drunkenly, not taking his eyes off the bride. "The older generation," I said, shaking my head as if it didn't include me. "They can't take any change. There's too much missingness that has already accumulated. They can't take any more." "Geez," Ian said, glancing up and over. "I wish my dad would just get over her." I swallowed more wine while holding Ian's lemonade. Over by the apple tree, there were three squirrels. A threesome of squirrels looked ominous, like a plague. "What other songs you got?" I asked him. Nikki was off talking to Johannes Hank. "I have to save a couple for the actual ceremony." "There's going to be an actual ceremony?" I asked. "Sort of. Maybe not actual. They have things they want to recite to each other," he said. "Oh, yes, that," I said. "They're going to walk up together from this canopy toward the house, say whatever, and then people get to eat." Everyone had brought food, and it was spread out on a long table between the house and the barn. I had brought two large roaster chickens cooked accidentally unclean while I was listening to Michael Jackson on my iPod. But the chickens had looked okay, I thought, hanging off the bone a bit, but otherwise fine, even if not as fine as when they had started and had been Amish and air-chilled and a fortune. When I had bought them the day before at Whole Foods and gasped at the total on my receipt, the cashier had said, "Yes, some people know how to shop here and some people don't." 33, 33, I said, "perhaps that's good luck." "Yep," said the cashier, "it's about as lucky as dead birds get to be." "Is there a priest or anything? Will the marriage be legal?" I now asked Ian. Ian smiled and shrugged. "They're going to say you do after the other one says I do. Double indemnity." I put his lemonade down on a nearby table and gave him a soft chuck on the shoulder. We both looked across the yard at Hank, who was wearing a tie made of small yellow pop beads that formed themselves into the shape of an ear of corn. It had ingeniousness and tackiness both, like so much else created by people. "That's a lot of dues," I said. "I know," he said, "but I'm not making a beeline for the jokes." "The jokes? Is that me making that noise? Yes? I don't know. The doozy one, the doo-doo one, I'm not going to make any of them." "Why would you make jokes?" I asked. "It's not like you're the best man." Ian looked down and twisted his mouth a little. "Oh dear," I said, "you are?" I squinted at him. When young, I had practiced doing the upside-down wink of a bird. "Don't ask," he said. "Hey, look," I put my arm around him. "George Harrison did it, and no one thought twice. Or, well, no one thought more than twice." Nikki approached me quickly from across the grass. "Mom, your chickens look disgusting. It's like they were hit by a truck." The wedding party had started to line up, except Ian, who had to play. They were going to get the ceremony over with quickly before the storm clouds to the west drifted near and made things worse. The bridesmaids began stepping first, a short trajectory from the canopy to the rose bushes where the I do's would be said. Ian played Here Comes the Bride. The bridesmaids were in pastels. One, the light peach of baby aspirin. One, the seafoam green of low-dose clonazepam. The other, the pale daffodil of the next lowest dose of clonazepam. What a good idea to have the look of Big Pharma at your wedding. Why hadn't I thought of that? Why hadn't I thought of that until now? I take thee, dear Maria. They were uttering these promises themselves, just as Ian said they would. Hank said, I do, and Maria said, you do, then vice versa. At least Maria had taken off her sunglasses. Young people, I tried not to say out loud with a sigh. Time went slowly, then stood still, then became undetectable, so who knew how long all this was taking. A loud noise, like mechanized thunder, was coming from the highway. Strangely, it was not a storm. A group of motorcyclists boomed up the road, and instead of roaring by us, slowed, then turned right in at the driveway, a dozen of them, all on Harleys. I didn't really know motorcycles, but I knew that every biker from Platteville to Manitowoc owned a Harley. That was just a regional fact. They switched off their engines. None of the riders wore a helmet. They wore bandanas, except for the leader, who wore a football helmet with some plush puppy ears, which had been snipped from some child's stuffed animal, then glued on either side. He took out a handgun and fired it 3 times into the air. Several guests screamed. I could make no sound at all. The biker with the gun and the puppy ears began to shout, I have a firearms license, and those were blanks, and this is self-defense because our group here has an easement that extends just this far into this driveway. Also, we were abused as children and as adults, and moreover, we have been eating a hell of a lot of Twinkies. Also, we are actually very peaceful people. We just know that life can get quite startling in its switches of channels, that there is a river and sea figure of speech as well as a TV one, which is why, as life moves rudely past, you have to give it room. We understand that. An occasion like this means no more forks in the road. All mistakes are behind you, and that means it's no longer really possible to make one. Not a big one. You already done that. I need to speak first here to the bride. He looked around, but no one moved. He cleared his throat a bit. The errors a person already made can step forward and announce themselves and then freeze themselves into a charming little sculpture garden that can no longer hurt you. Like a cemetery, and like a cemetery, it is the kind of freedom that is the opposite of free. He looked in a puzzled way across the property toward Maria. It's the flickering quantum zone of gun and none, got and not, he said. He shifted uncomfortably, as if the phrase flickering quantum zone had taken a lot out of him. As I said, now I need to speak to the bride. Would that be you? Maria shouted at him in Portuguese. Her bridesmaids joined in. What are they saying? I murmured to Nikki. I forgot all my Portuguese, Nikki said. My whole childhood, I only remember Maria saying good job to everything I did, so I now think of that as Portuguese. Yes, I murmured, so do I. Good job, Nikki shouted belligerently at the biker. Good job being an asshole and interrupting a wedding. Nikki, leave this to the grown-ups, I whispered. But the guests just stood there, paralyzed, except Ian, who, seemingly very far off on the horizon, slowly stood, placing his guitar on the ground. He then took his white collapsible chair in both hands and raised it over his head. Are you Caitlin? The puppy-eared biker continued to address Maria, and she continued to curse, waving her sprigs of mint and spirea at him. She gave him the finger, and when Hank tried to calm her, she gave Hank the finger. The cyclist looked around, and with an expression that suggested he believed he might have the wrong country wedding, he took out his cell phone, took off his helmet, pressed someone on speed dial, then turned to speak into it. Yo, Joe, I don't think you gave me the right address. Yeah, no, you don't get it. This ain't Caitlin's place. What? No, listen, what I'm saying is wrong address C. This ain't it. no speakeasy English here. He slammed his phone shut. He put his helmet back on. But Ian was trotting slowly toward him, with the chair over his head, crying the yelping cry of anyone who was trying to be a hero at his ex-wife's wedding. "Sorry, people," the biker said. He gave the approaching Ian only a quick, unfazed double take. He flicked one of his puppy ears at him and hurried to straddle his bike. "Wrong address, everybody." Then his whole too-stoned-to-be-menacing gang started up their engines and rode away in a roar, kicking up dust from the driveway gravel. It was a relief to see them go. Ian continued to run down the road after them, howling, chair overhead, though the motorcyclists were quickly out of sight. "Should we follow Ian?" asked Nikki. Someone near us was phoning the police. "Let Ian get it out of his system," I said. "Yeah," she said, and now made a beeline for Maria. "Good job," I could hear Nikki say to Maria. "Good job getting married." And then Nikki threw her arms around her former caretaker and began, hunched and heaving, to weep on her shoulder. I couldn't bear to watch. There was a big black zigzag across my heart. I could hear Maria say, "Thank you for coming, Nikki. You and your mother are my heroes." Ian had not returned, and no one had gone looking for him. He would be back in time for the rain. There was a rent-a-disc jockey who started to put on some music, which blared from the speakers, Michael Jackson again. Every day there was something new to mourn and something old to celebrate. Civilization had learned this long ago and continued to remind us. Was that what the biker had meant? I moved now toward the buffet table. "You know, when you're hungry, there's nothing better than food," I said to a perfect stranger. I cut a small chunk of ham. I placed a deviled egg in my mouth and resisted the temptation to position it in front of my teeth and smile scarily the way we had done as children. I chewed and swallowed and grabbed another one. Soon, no doubt, I would resemble a large vertical snake who had swallowed a rat, that rat Ben. Snakes would eat a sirloin steak only if it was disguised behind the head of a small rodent. There was a lesson somewhere in there, and just a little more wine would reveal it. "Oh, look at those sad chickens," I said ambiguously and with my mouth full. There were rumors that the wedding cake was still being frosted and that it would take a while. A few people were starting to dance before the dark clouds burst open and ruined everything. Next to the food table was a smaller one displaying a variety of insect repellents, aerosols, and creams, as if it were the vanity corner of a posh ladies' room, except with discreet constellations of gnats. Guests were spraying themselves a little too close to the food, and the smells of citronella and imminent rain combined in the air. The biker was right. You had to unfreeze your feet, take blind steps backward, risk a loss of balance, risk an endless fall in order to give life room. Was that what he had said? Who knew? People were shaking their bodies to Michael Jackson's "Shake Your Body." I wanted this song played at my funeral. Also, the Doobie Brothers taking it to the streets. Also, "Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas," just to fuck with people. I put down my paper plate and plastic wine glass. I looked over at Ian's dad, who was once again brooding off by himself. "Come dance with someone your own age," I called to him. And because he did not say, "That is so not going to happen," I approached him from across the lawn. As I got closer, I could see that since the days he would sometimes come to our house to pick up Maria and drive her home himself in the silver sports car of the recently single, he had had some eye work done, a lift to remove the puff and bloat. He would rather look startled and insane than look 56. I grabbed both his hands and reeled him around. "Whoa," he said, with something like a smile, and he let go with one hand to raise it over his head and flutter it in a jokey jazz razzmatazz. In sign language, it was the sign for applause. I needed my breath for dancing, so I tried not to laugh. Instead, I fixed my face into a grin, and for a second, the sun came out to light up the side of the red and spinning barn. Thank you very much. You want to bring the... We're willing to take questions, or we'll just, we haven't seen each other in a while, so we can just talk.
I know. I'm so glad you read that story.
Oh, thank you.
That's excellent.
Thank you.
It's like, you know, it's a classic Laurie Moore character.
Oh,
right?
Let's not do that.
I mean,
that's not
right? It's like the heart of a teenager, but the mind of, a much older and wiser person who just can't help but zero in on everything. It's great.
Oh.
But not that much older.
Yeah, exactly. Not that much older. I sort of thought of this story as my farewell to Wisconsin, since it ends with a barn and it's spinning.
That's hilarious.
So if any of you have a question, why don't you raise your hand and we will get a microphone.
We're willing to,
you. To
give it a shot. We probably won't know the answers, but we'll try.
Did you ever really do that?
What?
Cook two chickens on clean?
I did cook one chicken on clean. That's how I know it's possible, because there was an issue with
it. It's like seared, though, right?
I think my oven was not working that well. I think the clean function was
right.
Broken. But, it was unclean by mistake. Yeah. But it got very hot. I wouldn't recommend it.
Right,
I wouldn't,
right.
But... I did it. So it is possible, and it's possible still to eat the chicken. That issue came up with the fact checkers in the galleys, because they said, we don't think it's possible. I said, well, I did it. I did it once, so.
I didn't know fiction was fact checked. Not that much nonfiction is these days, but.
Fiction is fact checked all the time. Yeah,
I think so.
We'll tell you our horror stories.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, they couldn't fact check mine. It's all made up, so they knew that.
Well, mine's made up too, but they still fact check it a little bit. A little, you know. And then you can insist on things being against the facts if you want. If you say, you know, it's fiction, it needs to be this way for the story.
Well, with so many references to the current culture, is that ever a legal issue?
A legal issue?
Yeah, I mean, is that something that gets brought up as well?
What would be the legal issue?
Oh, a copyright infringement. You're saying you're using our lyrics. But I guess you get permission for that.
Using
that
lyrics?
That poor woman who became a rhododendron. Yeah. She'd come back.
Oh, that's fiction. Besides,
of course it is.
I know, you can't libel the dead. That's a basic legal concept.
Anyone else?
Come on, join us.
Thank you both of you so much. I really enjoyed hearing both of your writings. This is more of a general question for both of you. Was there a point in either of your lives where you consciously decided to become a writer, or did you conscientiously always study writing and creative writing and language, or was there a point where you like made a conscious decision that you really wanted to be published and you really wanted to do this?
I want to hear you answer that.
Well, I did make a conscious decision because I quit a job to start writing. And this was when I was 22, 23, maybe 20, just
and
about 23.
You quit a good job.
I quit a good job. It was according to my parents, it was a good job.
Because I quit a bad job, so that's not the same commitment.
Yeah. So I did quit the job.
Mm-hmm.
And I did tell people that I wanted to write, you know, a novel. So I guess... I came clean about it, and but before that, I didn't really study creative writing. I mean, I took a class or two in high school, well, just one, but I didn't really take it in college. I was just an English major. I just read a lot, and.
And you weren't writing in college at all.
I was sort of writing on my own.
Yeah.
Yeah, but not in the form. I think I was too shy, and I just. It freaked me out to think about, you know, sharing that stuff. And it's funny because I teach a writing class now, and I just assume that everyone's perfectly fine with it. But but they're probably not.
So, no, it's yeah. hard. Yeah. It, yeah. yeah. And then, but then you went to Oregon.
I did end up, you know, failing at the book that I, you know, quit my nice job for, and deciding that I needed to go. I got this very little fellowship, but it was enough to go to a graduate program, and that's where I ended up writing my first published novel. That was Native Speaker, yeah.
It's an amazing book. Yeah. Such an amazing. And you wrote that as a graduate student. That,
yeah, I started speaking? That in my first for my first workshop.
Wow.
And,
wow.
And
what did you submit to get into the program?
My failed novel. And
so it didn't.
And really. That was that. I thought, you know, there was probably about a 2-week period where I thought it was brilliant. but the, you know, probably the. The rest of the time, I was desperate, and I searched. I remember searching it obsessively for good stuff. Like I reread it all the time, hoping that I'd, you know, like an archaeologist discover something.
Oh, that you could use like a paragraph.
Yeah, yeah. Well, or just that would sort of gird me and you know keep me sort of confident. But I really didn't. But there were little flashes, I think, of something okay, and that was enough. And I think the Oregon program at the time was deeply in trouble, so they needed. They were just looking for. I'm serious. They really were looking for just people from outside that town to go there.
That's so not true.
Yeah, it is so true. It's so true. What about you, Lori?
No,
you were always writing in college, in high school too, right?
A little. Yeah. I mean, I would take creative writing and do the assignments, but mostly I was just turning them into the teacher. So I could be really shy and bashful, but then I could turn.
It wasn't workshop.
Wasn't workshop till later. But not in high school, not the early part of college. You just were turning it into the teacher.
You had to trust your teacher, I suppose.
And the teacher would write very nice things, so I was clearly easily encouraged.
That was great.
Yeah.
And how about moving on to publishing? I mean, did you start with small magazines, or did you present a full selection to a publisher?
I did win the 17 magazine contest when I was 19, but I just thought that was the beginning and the end of my writing career. I didn't think that it was. I didn't. Initially, I thought, oh, this is going to be easy, and then I started sending things out, and everything was rejected. And so then I basically gave up, you know, fiction writing, and decided to become a poet. And then I decided, I don't know. I kind of abandoned it for a little while. But the serious stories I was writing in my mid-20s, we'll say, I did send out to small journals, literary journals. Mm-hmm. And just kept going that way. Good. So
there was a lady in the middle who had a question.
Thank you. This is a question from Ms. Moore. I am a big fan of all of your work, starting with self-help. So again, your work that you were writing when you were in graduate school also. But Anagrams is actually one of my favorite texts of all times, and I've taught it many times with great success. But I know that in at least one interview, you have expressed reservations about that book and said you were really not that pleased with it. And I wonder, as time has gone by, if you've changed your assessment of or your reflection of that book, and I was just curious about that.
Well, I haven't gone back to read it, but I think maybe about 2 years ago I just opened it randomly to a page and then I screamed and slapped it shut. I assume it's not that good, but it was a first novel by some, I mean, and I didn't know what I was doing. And so as soon as you don't know what you're doing, you get really, really ambitious. I know, I'm going to do this cubistic thing. It will be like nude descending a staircase. And, you know, it just... but I don't. I haven't looked at it. I mean, I think you're rather alone, and I'm sorry to say, in the world... You're rather alone and liking it, and my, you know, I really am
very grateful to you. But your students might not be. I don't know. I mean, I was in my 20s when I wrote it, and I was writing about a woman who was almost 10 years older than I was at the time. I didn't know what I was talking about. I didn't know, but I don't know. I haven't really looked. You know, did you see this interview with Philip Roth where he said, supposedly, unless it was just mistranslated from the Swedish, he said he reread all of his work every single year?
I read that.
Do you believe?
Every single year? No.
That's what he said. That's how it read. But oh, that I thought must he be said, a mistake.
Yeah, I think no.
That's got to be
even
a mistake.
For Philip Roth. Yeah. I mean, I think it was just this year, you know, when he decided.
That must have been a... Yeah. Right, I think that was... Yeah.
Can
right.
you imagine doing that?
Reading
your own work, even once through.
No, I just have no desire to do that. No, no desire.
Yeah.
Have you gone back and looked at Native Speaker, though?
No.
Have you gone back to... how about the novel that you say is that you left your job for?
Luckily, that's... in, you know, a 5 1/4 floppy disk.
But have you looked at it to see?
No, no, no.
But it might be good.
No, no, no. You know, I knew I was in trouble because I ended up, while I was writing Native Speaker, sometimes you don't want to, after a while, you don't want to workshop novels. And so I didn't want to bring new pieces. I just didn't want to, you know, I didn't want to have any other noise about what I was writing and caring about. So I ended up bringing in chapters of that book. And just because I had written them, and I, you know, didn't have to do any work, and so I just put, and I knew it was bad because sort of the worst writers in the class really loved it, like really bizarre people. So
you had this sort of fake workshop novel.
I did.
While you wrote
I did
another novel.
I did. I did. I had like the yeah, the stand-in.
That's
you know,
a good
the,
idea.
The understudy, and really it was a smash with a certain little coterie of people in the workshop. And they wanted to see more of it, and I said...
And so you said, no problem.
Yeah.
You'll see more of it in 4 weeks.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely... Laura, you're absolutely right about it. When you don't know anything, you get super ambitious.
Right.
Right, and that's what I was doing with that book. It had, like, a play within a play. Part of it was in Byronic couplets.
Did you say Byronic or Bionic?
I thought they were Bionic. Or Byronic. Yeah, I mean, it was all over the place. And it was going to be my homage to, you know, every writer that I'd ever loved.
There's something to be said for simplicity and keeping things a little simple. Yeah. But when you're young, your brain is on fire. It's actually the best time to do all kinds of things, you know.
But maybe not write a novel.
Maybe not right.
You know, Ishiguro's got this theory that you do your best work. It's your first or second book, and then after that, it's all downhill.
Well, we know why he says that.
I don't know that he would disagree with you, except Never Let Me Go. It's a terrific book.
Well, yeah. An Artist of Floating World, that's a beautiful book. That's his second novel, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Beautiful book. Moving on. Does anyone else have a question? Yeah, right here in the second row.
Well, I'm interested always in writers who write through someone from the opposite sex. So I'm interested, I understand sort of naturally your writing with the voice that you have, but I'm really interested in your writing about Fan and what you think about men writing about women and women having a man as the main character.
Well, actually, in this book, I don't write in Fan's voice. You know, it's this other narrator, so it's really just... So I don't think it's quite what you're talking about. And I've never inhabited... You know, in a first-person way, a female character. In third person, yes. So, and I think it's totally great and allowable. It's just I guess I haven't felt comfortable enough, or been interested in doing that yet. And I hope I will, but But so I don't really have an answer for you. I mean, I just I do think that we get too caught up on who's writing what sometimes. And you know, if I'm writing some character, say my third novel, who's not of Asian heritage, people get all bent out of shape. Or even sometimes if I write about women, sometimes people get bent out of shape. Because I think, you know, it depends, I suppose, on what kind of reader you are. I think a lot of readers, not a lot, but I think some readers, you know, come to works with a lot of ideas about what they're going to expect and what they want, rather than, which is, you know, rather than coming to work and just kind of being open. As to what that book is trying to do and its form and its, you know, its subject matter. So I don't know if you have any.
I've never written in a male voice either, but I'm thinking about trying it. I've tried it before, and I mean voice, not perspective. A male point of view I have done, and I don't know. It's really fun. And it doesn't, it just seems, if you feel like you know the guy, if you feel like you know this character, then you can write in his point of view. But actually doing the voice of a man, as he says, and then I get into the car and I drive, I mean, I don't know. I think, how
put
would
on
a,
my belt.
I know. How would a man say this? How would a man say? And then I found some, you know, food in my teeth. What a man! You know, sometimes you think that the voice of the opposite sex goes to the very grammar of things, and that even though you can, the story can have a voice, and you can tilt the point of view to the opposite sex and devise a character, and men and women know each other very well, but somehow when you go to actually do the voice, it's much harder. I mean, great books are written, you know. You know who the greatest book that's done in the voice of the opposite sex is, what, I don't know, Maya Antonia.
It's not done very
well.
Willa
Cather did. Willa Cather did it a couple times, I think. But it's first person male, male voice. You know, and then perspective. You know, Tolstoy, Flaubert, those great novels are done.
Has a man ever written a great novel in a woman's first person voice? Wally, I haven't read that. Roddy Doyle.
Oh, yeah. The Woman Who Walked Into Doors.
He can do anything.
Well, there's another question.
Let's take it, and then we're going to have to end there, unfortunately.
I was curious to know how much is known, I guess, in terms of structure and story before you sat down to start writing.
I'm curious about your story, this story particularly. Could you?
Oh, well, this, you know, it's when you have an occasion like a wedding, it's sort of simple because it has its own parameters. I did go to a wedding the day after Michael Jackson died, you know. So I was drawing from some real things, and weddings are essentially comedic, and essentially, and I wanted to end the book with a wedding to prove that the book was a comedy. So I had the parameters of the occasion and an imminent thunderstorm coming in, and they had to dance before it started to rain. So you know, so you have some, you have an outline a little bit to work within, and then you know, then there are surprises inside, paragraph by paragraph, as you move the characters around and get them talking.
Well, it begins at Easter, too, so there's this sense of renewal from the very beginning, even though poor Ira.
Right.
Well, unfortunately, we have to wrap it up. Please join me in thanking Chang Rae Lee and Laurie Moore. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.